7:44 on a Wednesday morning here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTKA, online at WTKA.com. Coming up in probably the next segment, probably about 15 minutes from now, we'll get into the recruiting roundup. But for now, Ira, how many days until the beginning of the Michigan football season?
24 days, Sam.
And that's the what's the 24th Michigan team?
The 11-0-1 national championship team of 1903. And that its significance of the 1903 team is not that they won the national championship.
What is the significance of the 1903 team?
They left behind a 30-cent piece of equipment.
Which Chris, the intern, told us equates to
about 10 bucks
about
now.
Can
you buy a 5-gallon jug of anything for 10 bucks now?
And joining us right now to talk
about. Big, Sam, what are those big like orange Gatorade jugs cost now?
I bet
you more than 10 bucks.
They probably get them for free. You know, it's probably
touche.
Exactly. But joining us right now is the foremost expert on the jug. I can't think of another individual alive that knows more about the Little Brown Jug than from mvictors.com, Greg Dooley.
Sam and Ira, what's going on? I got the jug bat signal yesterday from Ira.
I pointed it to the sky. It's got M's on both sides of it with a little handle.
Yes, and I will qualify Sam's statement. Perhaps the foremost expert, certainly before, say, 1940 and 50 and that kind of thing. Uh-huh. So the early history of the jug, I've made it a personal duty over the last couple of years to find out as much as I could about it.
Right.
It all started in 1903, as you guys pointed out.
And so, give us the background. First of all, Ira gave the unbelievable scoring, 545-6 or something like that.
565-6. The six were in the 6-6 tie to Minnesota, which of course is where they left the jug behind.
So were they just so shocked that they tied a game left the jug behind?
Not one, I should say, under Yost.
They had not lost a game, and Yost of course came down campus in 1901 and basically smoked everybody. And then midway or a little later in the season, October 31st, 1903, they head to Minnesota. They score. Minnesota ties the game, and they end the game in a 6-6 tie. And yes, I would say people in Ann Arbor were a little stunned, but I think that was more turned into a positive energy in Minnesota, where they considered the whole thing a victory and went crazy and celebrated that. Imagine that. They actually tied a Yost football team.
And so give us the background that to the jug part of the story. They leave the jug behind. They realize they left it. They want it back. And take us through all that.
Well, it's interesting because you talk about what the value of the jug was. So I'll talk about that in a second. But so the story goes, as we understand it today, because it's actually changed over the years as more information has come out. But the story today, as we understand it, is that, of course, they made the trip to Minnesota, and Yost needed a water jug, like teams do. I'm sure they usually travel with them. Perhaps they had other ones, but they needed it. So they have an equipment manager named Tommy Roberts on the team. He runs out, the John Falk of the day. He runs out and buys a 30-cent water jug. And, of course, for the team to use. Well, after the game, after this brutally, brutally hard-fought game, and we can get into that in a little bit, Michigan leaves. Kind of abruptly, but leaves. And stories vary, but the next day or so, Minnesota's equipment manager was cleaning up the locker room and found the jug and decided to make it a trophy of sorts, a relic from this great tie that they had. And what he did was he took it into the office of the athletic director, and they painted on it. And it said, Michigan jug, and it said captured in quotes by Oscar Munson, who's the equipment manager. And on the back, they wrote the score: Michigan 6, tiny little 6, Minnesota big giant 6. Okay. And what happened from there, this is where kind of the story gets a little foggy, but what happened there is the athletic director actually took it and hung it like a trophy in his office in the Minnesota Armory, and there it stood for 6 years until they played again in 1909. Okay. But what the common story is that Fielding Yost said, realized somehow that he left a water jug behind that he paid 30 cents for that is worth 10 bucks today or whatever, and wrote back and said, hey, I want my jug back. And the fact is everything I can find that. And then, of course, no, Minnesota said, no, you can't have it back. You got to win it back.
Right. That's the common story, right?
And that is the common story. Okay. And that's kind of permeated through today. Okay. But that's not quite what happened. So I can tell you about that. I mean, what I understand happened is a little different from that.
Okay, which is?
Okay. So well, first of all, you got to ask a question. Why would Fielding Yost, this coach, and by the way, that Michigan earned over just about $14,000 in gate revenue from Minnesota that game. Okay, so they could have bought 40,000 some odd little brown jugs. Okay, why would he demand a water jug be returned that they just purchased right before the game? Okay, and what happened is when the story kind of evolved throughout the first part of the century, the common assumption was that Michigan, this was a precious thing that Michigan brought to the game. Uh-huh. And they brought it with their own water because they didn't trust the Minnesota water. And it wasn't found. It was stolen. Okay. So all these kind of stories kind of hyped up the jug. You think sports writers take liberties today or bloggers or whatever? Think about how many liberties they might have taken with a thing that isn't even part of the real game, which is the jug. So what really happened was that it hung in Doc Cook, the athletic director's office. And right before the 1909 game, which is the next time they played, they didn't have these set schedules. You know, they had relationships with team, but typically it was year to year. They didn't meet till 1909. And the athletic director from Minnesota said, hey, this might be a cool tradition. And he brought it to a pep rally before the game. And Yost was summoned to his office, and he kind of said, hey, what's that? And he goes, you know, that's the jug, you guys, from our last game. We painted it up and everything. Wouldn't it be fun to play for it? So that's when they kind of agreed in 1909 to say, yeah, gotcha, we'll play for it. And that's when they decided to play for it.
Yeah, the other story is a little more compelling, a little more captivating. It makes a little more dramatic.
Well, it is.
No, it is.
But okay, let's just say as I understand it, my story is correct. Don't you have to inject some type of why do they even play for this joke? Who cares? Uh-huh. But you know what? To me, it's cool enough that the fact that it is truly a piece of memorabilia from that game. Uh-huh. It was used in the game. Willie Heston sipped from that jug in 1903, and they've played for it in 1909 and played for it since. So.
Almost every year, right?
Oh, just about every year.
And now it'll be back on.
And 1 year twice, that's 1926. Right. So,
okay. All right. Yeah. That's the kind of historical perspective that you get from Greg Dooley at mvictors.com. There's no site like it. No one does what he does.
And since we have him here, we had the question, I think it was from Eugene, about the painting of the wings on the helmets. You want to, Greg, tell how that's done?
I didn't hear the question, but I assume he wanted to know whether they're decals or it's painted. And it's absolutely painted on. And there's a couple of different companies that paint the helmets today. One of them, the folks that paint the Schutt brand helmets, are down in Oxford, Ohio. And you may know Oxford, Ohio is Miami of Ohio. That's where John Falk and, of course, Bo came from, the current equipment manager. And when John Falk came here, he had them recondition the helmets down in Oxford. And they have a process. It starts with a orangey-type shell. There's a certain color, Vegas gold or something like that shell. It is painted. It is taped. And they use tape to, like, tape off the wings, paint it maize, and then paint the blue, peel off the tape, and that reveals it. So if you look in some of, especially the old pictures where they weren't primed quite the same, you can actually see the wings chipping off and the orange maize color of the orange color of the helmet come through. So they're absolutely painted. They do a much better job of it today. The other thing is John Falk and his crew will go through where the blue paint has chipped off, and they have a pen that they use to kind of fill in where those orange kind of dots and specks are from the helmet clashes.
Mm-hmm. So he said, what are they taking the wings off? No, they just never applied the wings is what we were trying to tell the caller on those helmets that didn't have wings last year.
Right. Well, I figured a couple of different things, that they either covered them or they had some blue ones that they had. Just shell blue ones. So. That was quite an incident there.
Yeah, it was. Again, well, you said the name Willie Heston. I knew this guy was going to call. JJ in Lincoln Park at 7:54. What do you have for us, JJ?
Well, I love the story about the little brown jug. I would like to add the following, that I've done extensive reading on this Minnesota game, because it was the only game at Michigan where Willie Heston didn't walk off the field a winner. It was a tie. And the two things I find interesting about this game is when Minnesota scored in the last 2-3 minutes of the game, the fans rushed the field because Nobody had scored on Yost's team all year, and Michigan had to put a pretty solid 23-6 whipping on the Gophers the year before in our homecoming game at the last game of the season. And by the time they got order restored, the captains of the team agreed just to walk off the field because it looked like an approaching storm was coming. The wind was howling and all that kind of stuff. And according to the papers and the stuff I could do, Michigan had left the jug on their bench that day. That's how I understood it. They didn't bring it back to the locker room. They left the jug on the bench that day. Is that that's the story I understood. Am I wrong on that?
Yeah, JJ, there are different stories about when it was found and where it was found. The most common thing I can read is that it was found Sunday in the locker room. Okay. I have heard, again, the field, I heard it was stolen from the sideline, a lot of different stories, but the most common story I've read and heard on the recaps from the equipment managers that it was found in the locker room.
Well, do you remember the opening kickoff of that game? Back in those days, you weren't down, even though you got knocked down, until people stopped your forward progress so you could crawl on the ground. And they put a stop to Willie Hudson on the first team by trying to twist his leg and biting his finger and trying to rip his ear off.
That's right.
I think part of that story comes from John Borton in the Wolverine Handbook, too. That's another source that I found out on that game. So it was a pretty rough and tumble game. And they invented a new defense called the Diamond or the Seven-Man Front. It was the first time it was ever employed in college football to stop Willie Heston. And they did kind of control Willie that day.
Well, JJ, here's the other thing they did. They practically beat the man. And as Willie Heston said, they kicked him in the head. He was beaten down. Now, Yost downplayed all that after the game. He was a pretty good sportsman about it. But one of the strategies they used to do to these hurry-up teams, and what Yost would do is he would line it up very quickly and run it down your throat. One strategy the other team, you know, employed was to pile on, was to kick, was to punch. And by some accounts, you know, many, many, many time was spent dealing with injured players. And certainly it was a brutal game, absolutely. But the man they were going after, JJ, was your boy, Willie Heston.
And the greatest running back of all time.
All right. Thanks a lot, as always, JJ. And I want to say thanks to Mr. Dooley, Greg Dooley from Invictors.com, for coming down and giving us our history lesson for today. We, you know, when Ira said this is the Brown Jug game, it was automatic. We knew who to call.
That's just a taste. I've got so much more. You can read more on Invictors. Click Little Brown Jug Lore. And boy, I'm guessing Minnesota week, I'll probably be back in to tell you some more stories because there's a lot more where that came from.
As a matter of fact.
And of course, every Saturday this week in Michigan football history.
There you go.
And don't forget to check me out in Go Blue Wolverine magazine, Sam.
Man, this is just a plug fest, man. 7:57 on a Wednesday. Speaking of plugs, let me plug the recruiting roundup coming up on the other side. So if you have your recruiting questions, get them ready. 734-998-1050. Tweet them at Michigan Insider. Email them to studio@WTKA.com. We will get to them on the other side here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTKA.